we have tonight with us, author and mystic visionary John Lamlash. Good evening, John. I am so glad that you could make it tonight.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be with you.
The pleasure is all ours. Now, I think we should just go ahead and jump right into it. Well, you know, John, it's been said about you that you awaken the urge in us, not unlike Joseph Campbell, to reconnect to the sacred myth and archetypes encoded upon humanity's collective soul. And that's why we thought it would be important to have you come on the show and share your vision with us tonight. Now, your work brings a distinct message to humanity, a call to action for a species-wide planetary vision quest. So let's let that be our focus this evening. Now,
that's perfect. Yes.
Okay, great. Well, just jumping right in. Specifically, you wrote on your website back in 2005, metahistory.org, when I first discovered your work after your appearance on Coast to Coast. You wrote that knowing Gaia is not a matter of belief. It is a vision quest for the entire species. Recognition of Sophia, the wisdom of the earth, was common to all indigenous people in former times. That when this quest was accomplished by contemplating the animation of the material and sensory world, we move into a deeper rapport with the mysterious source of life itself. Could you elaborate some on this?
Certainly. That particular passage that you cite is a concise sort of a distillation of the message of metahistory.org. It also could be considered a distillation of the message and teaching of the ancient pagan mysteries that were centered on this mythological figure of Sophia, which is a Greek word for wisdom. Sophia was identified in these ancient mysteries as the actual divine presence that indwells the planet that we inhabit. So as some of your listeners may know, we have a fashion today. For some 20 or 30 years, it has become fashionable to refer to the Earth as a superorganism or a living being by the name Gaia. And that would be a reference to the so-called Gaia hypothesis or Gaia theory that was proposed by James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis. So I proposed this hyphenated term, Gaia Sophia, to describe the living presence of the Earth as it was known and understood in the ancient mysteries. I think that one way to introduce this concept to people and what I'd like to do when I speak about Gaia Sophia is to present as best I can the sense of the immediacy and the accessibility of this concept. This is a myth, certainly, and I'm very flattered to be put in the tradition of a great mythologist like Joseph Campbell. But we need to understand that a myth is a description of reality lived and reality that can be lived. That is a true myth. Myth is not a fiction. It is not a fabrication invented in the place of due to ignorance. For instance, the myth of the discovery of fire might be considered to be a made-up story created by people who didn't really know how fire was discovered. That is certainly not the sense of a myth as I use it, and I'm sure you would understand that basically as well.
Absolutely.
I think that something that could lead us into the subject very directly is the comparison of human existence, of the presence of the human species on Earth, the comparison of our biological existence and our imaginative existence. And this distinction is really a great inroad. I feel it's an immediate inroad to the understanding of Sophia and the planetary vision quest. Now, of course, we all understand the first part. We are biological creatures of the Earth, obviously, right?
Yes.
We're animals, just like other animals, who inhabit the biosphere. and we have physical form, and some people don't like to consider us as animals, but I do consider us as just another animal, not a superior one necessarily, but an exceptional one. We certainly don't behave like the other animals in the biosphere, and in fact, the Gnostic teachings of the mysteries will explain why this is so, because they explain the origin of the human genome and of the human species. And so we can all grasp that we are biological children of Gaia, let's say. That's obvious. What the mystery teachings show us is that we are not just that, but that we are also the imaginative subjects of Gaia. We do not merely live in this terrestrial atmosphere. We also are creatures, subjects of her imagination. And her imagination, the imagination of the Earth, is just as real and potent as the biological body of the Earth. If you can get that concept on board, that is really a massively significant part of the ancient mystery teachings. We live in the habitat of the Earth, provided by Gaia, and simultaneously, we live in the imagination of this divine goddess, Sophia. And so if you can grasp that going in, and it's a momentous opportunity, you can understand that the essence of the mystery teachings is interactivity. As long as we still confine ourselves to being biological creatures, well, we're kind of living off the earth, and we kind of interact with it in the sense that we breathe its air and we harvest the vegetables and fruits that it presents, or we hunt the animals that we need to live and eat. In that sense, we are somewhat interactive with our environment. But just imagine to be interactive with the source of this environment, with the divine being who conceived our environment in the first place and who embodies the planet in a physical sense. And this is the opportunity of the Planetary Vision Quest, to enter into the most intimate interactivity with the living presence of the Earth.
So having said that, would you say that whether or not we are actively participating in this imaginative existence as subjects of Gaia, are we nonetheless that in that state?
We are certainly in that state. And we have the choice to be in that state consciously and intentionally.
Okay.
Another example that may be helpful here is the example of breathing.
Okay.
Now, as I talk to you now, I'm breathing. And I'm speaking to you, and we're having a conversation, and people are listening to our conversation, and we're all breathing, aren't we?
Yes.
But we don't have to really pay attention to it, do we?
No.
We don't have to stop and think, gee, I'm breathing. Am I breathing in now, or am I breathing out, you know?
Right.
Because we are set up in the natural world in such a way that our breathing happens for us. It happens as an more or less automatic process. But
okay,
we also have the option to make our breathing intentional. For instance, if I say to you now, to everyone listening to me, stop and hold your breath for 5 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We just participated in an intentional ritual, as it were, that made our breathing conscious and intentional rather than automatic. So it's very clear, and of course, from this we can easily refer to pranayama, which is the ancient Sanskrit word for breath yoga or breath exercises. And we know that in the mystical traditions of Asia and India, and in China as well, the conscious control of breathing was considered to be one of the master techniques for evolving consciousness and for developing higher states of awareness. So it's very easy to draw this contrast between just the automatic and unconscious process of breathing and the intentional act of breathing. Well, likewise. Yeah, is that clear?
That's an excellent analogy. I really get that. That is really clear.
So let with me, planetary tantra and with the Sophanic vision, you have the opportunity to not just live automatically and unconsciously in Gaia's imagination. You're already there. But to become intentionally engaged with her and to actually interact with that divine being. And that interaction is totally open-ended. There is no program for it. There's a kind of framework for it that was can be found in the mystery school teachings, but it is a completely open-ended experiment. That is the divine experiment. How we as a human species, who were created by the goddess Sophia, can become interactive and co-evolve with her in this environment.
Okay, excellent. Now, you propose the term biomysticism for empathic and visionary participation with the life force. And you quote Reich, Wilhelm Reich, who wrote that mysticism means, in the literal sense, a change of sensory impressions and organic sensations into something unreal or beyond this world. Both devil and angel correspond to human structural sensations that deviate basically from those of animals and primitive people. Now, where does this leave the individual seeker?
Well, it can lead either away from the mystery and away from interaction with the divine source of our life, or it can lead toward it, depending on how you view this term mysticism. Now, I'd like to say something about Reich for a moment, because he's a very important figure in my own personal journey for truth. And I don't know if many people know about him so much today. Wilhelm Reich was an early pioneer of psychology, and he was first a protege of Sigmund Freud, but then he broke away and he founded his own philosophy, his own view of things. And the quotation you just read is particularly important because it shows that Reich, who was a deep student of the life sciences, understood that mysticism, in a certain sense, has been a dissociation from the sensations of the body. This is what he claimed. For instance, Reich claimed that religious people who have visions of devils and angels and so forth are really just experiencing the sensations of their own body, but they're dissociated. They don't realize that they're experiencing how they are interacting with the natural environment, and so they falsely project it into something supernatural. And this is one of the dangers of mysticism and of spirituality in general, the danger of dissociation. On the other hand, I want to point out what I mean by the term biomysticism. Biomysticism means the mysticism of life, the mysticism that is grounded in the body, in nature, and in the real presence of living things. So there is a second kind of mysticism that does not take us away into fantasy and psychological projections, but takes us actually into the heart of the natural world and toward Gaia herself, toward the living planet. That is what I would call biomysticism.
Okay, that's great stuff. Jack, did you want to ask a question?
No, just keep on going, Mr. Lash.
Okay, all right. Well, I think he's just enthralled. We're just so excited to have you on. We've been following your work for so long, and it's really a pleasure and an honor. Let's move over just laterally a little. Now, can you elaborate the importance of developing what you call a mythical, literal theme of the wasteland in connection with the hero of the Grail quest, Parsifal?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Sure, you know, Joseph Campbell, who in some ways is considered my predecessor, wrote massively on mythology, covered the whole spectrum of mythology. He was a comparative mythologist. There are very few comparative mythologists in the world at any particular time, because comparative mythology is the study of the myths and legends of all cultures of all times. It's a vast overview. The tendency of people who go into the university to study mythology is to specialize. So they would just be specialists in Celtic mythology or Greek and Roman or Persian or Chinese mythology. Like Joseph Campbell, I'm a comparative mythologist. I've looked at all these different myths. And when you do so, first of all, I have to say it's a great privilege for me to be able to do that. And I dedicated a great part of my life to it at the cost of certain personal advantages, you could say, because it is such a vastly consuming study, obviously, that not everyone would have the time to do that, you know. So I made sure I had the time. And I can tell you, as someone who gave his complete attention to this subject, at the end of the day, you stand back and you look at the whole heap of mythologies, creation myths, myths of sexuality, myths of the discovery of fire, myths of war, myths of love, all the different themes. You sit back and you look at them like they were, say, these different props in a studio that have to do, that lead to different films. Each of these props is connected with a different film or a different movie. One of the things that I can guarantee you is very striking is that there are a couple of these props that really stand out as unique. Therefore, there are a couple of myths, just a couple, in the whole repertoire of the world that stand out as very, very unique. And one of these is the myth of the Holy Grail, the quest for the Holy Grail. In fact, in his big, massive volume, Creative Mythology, Joseph Campbell concentrated intensely on the analysis of this myth. He used the version of it. There are many versions of it, and some of them are Christianized. So I'd like to warn you, readers who are going to investigate the myth or legend of the Holy Grail, that most of them that you will encounter have been Christianized. And in those Christianized versions, which began with the version of Robert de Boron, who was a French writer in the 13th century, the Holy Grail story is associated very closely with the figure of Jesus Christ the Redeemer. And in fact, the Grail is identified often with the cup that was used to collect the blood of Christ on Golgotha. Supposedly it was owned by Joseph of Arimathea. It was also the Grail chalice in which the last wine of the Last Supper was served. Campbell, much to his credit, puts aside those Christian versions, and he looks at the much older pre-Christian version of the Grail quest. And the best rendition of that was written by a German knight called Wolfram von Eschenbach. And I also follow the von Eschenbach version of the story of Parzival. So I want to make that distinction for people who are going to look into this, want to investigate this material. Now, you just asked me, what is the wasteland and why is the question of the Grail such a significant myth for our time? Well, Joseph Campbell certainly thought so. I think you know that. Joe, have you read his Creative Mythology book?
Yes, I have a copy of it, actually.
Yeah.
I have.
It's massive. It's massive. There are a lot of digressions in it, I must say, but it is the most in-depth, apart from my own study, which is called An Alternative History of the Grail, which you'll find on metahistory.org. It is the only really in-depth study of the Grail legend. And Campbell points out that this Grail legend is the guiding myth of the Western world.
John, could you please continue the line of thought you were telling us about Parzival and the Holy Grail and how this and the planetary vision quest that this directive myth is a part of?
Sure. As I said, Joseph Campbell, the greatest comparative mythologist of the late 20th century, considered the legend of the Holy Grail to be the directing myth of Western spirituality, of the Western world. And to understand that enormous claim, we just need to look at two of the themes of the Parzival story of the Grail that was attained by the knight called Parzival. Two elements or two themes in the story will tell us everything we need to know. The first is the theme of the Grail itself. Well, what is the Holy Grail? And the second is the theme of the wasteland, or terre gaste, to use the old French term. Terre meaning earth, and gaste meaning wasted or devastated. And la terre gaste is a really important theme in this myth, because it refers to what happens to the earth, to the planet earth, when human beings no longer perceive it as sacred. When human beings, when the human species loses its connection with the imaginative dimension of the goddess, as I mentioned previously, then we begin to lose the sense that we are in a divine experiment with supernatural powers. And gradually, as that awareness fades out, we even lose the sense that there are divine and supernatural powers pervading the natural world. And as a result of that, the natural world turns into a wasteland in front of our eyes. And I think that, you know, these versions of the Holy Grail quest that have survived, mainly date from about the 10th, 11th, and 12th century. They're a little under 1,000 years old. And I think it's remarkable how obviously true they are, because it has come to the state, it has come to the place where humanity is looking at the planet, that it is treating the planet in such a way that it has become a wasteland, you know? And the technical term for this is desacralization, which means the removal of the sense of the sacred. Now, I just want to make one more point before I go on to the second theme here. What I mean when I say the word sacred, you know, generally we think that this has some religious meaning. And I would ask you to set aside your religious conceptions of it and just think, try to comprehend the word sacred in an energetic sense. Word sacred in English comes from a Greek or Indo-European root, S-A-C, sak, which is the same root as the Hindu word shakti. And in Hinduism and in Indian philosophy, shakti means the divine feminine power that animates the universe. It is the goddess power, and it is the power to materialize the worlds that we live in. So we live and breathe in a material world by the power of Shakti. Shakti simply means power, but with the connotation of divine feminine power. So what is the sacred? Well, the sacred is the root power that allows you to live. It's the source of your life. That's the sacred. And desacralization means we lose touch with the source. When we as a species lose touch with the power that gives us life, then life turns into a wasteland. We turn the world into a wasteland. We turn against nature. We defile, we violate, we rape, we exploit nature. We no longer respect her and her resources. And this is what has happened, and as actually beautifully predicted in the Grail legend. But the Grail legend is not just about the problem of the wasteland, which we are living in today, an ecological wasteland, economic wasteland, wasteland of entertainment, you know. It's not just about the problem, it's also about the solution. The solution to finding our way back to the sacred is to attain the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail is, in the most concise sense, that which we must encounter and experience in order to re-engage with the sacred. So the Holy Grail is not a symbol of something. It's not merely a symbol or an archetype, but is a powerful encounter with the supernatural that brings us back into a connection with the sacred. And that is why this story is so important, because it shows the way back to the sacred. Is that clear?
Absolutely. Yes. That's amazing. And so, can I just jump in for a second, Jack, and just say that so this is all precipitated with the seeking of an answer to a question. And that's the symbol, right? Is we're seeking.
That's right.
Did you want to elaborate on that?
There's an amazing plot structure of the story of Parsifal. An amazing plot structure. And you really have to... I suggest that everyone would go on metahistory.org and go to the Alternative History of the Grail, which is an entire book on the site. And if you go to the table of contents for that section of the site, you'll find that there is a synopsis of the story of Parsifal. And all the chapters in the book by Wolfram von Eschenbach are presented in a very concise synopsis. It is an absolutely fantastic and unique story. And just to, as a teaser, I'd like the listeners to know that the plot structure of Parsifal is really unusual because of the three conditions that are required for the seeker of the Grail. And in fact, these three conditions are very, very interesting. The first condition is that the seeker of the Grail, the one who will attain the Grail, must be the son of a widow. This is a very interesting statement, you know. Now, just want to qualify this. That may rule a lot of you out. You know, I happen to be the son of a widow. That's a fact. But I am literally the son of a widow. But we can all be the sons of a widow. Men and women can both be the children of a widow in a broader symbolic sense. What does that mean? Well, the widow is the woman who has lost her male counterpart. So, if you are a son or daughter of the widow, it means that you have been removed from the male, from the patriarchy. That is the actual meaning of that requirement. You have been removed from the patriarchal order. So you go on this quest because you are seeking to transcend and even to defeat and overcome the perils and the dangers and the illusions of the patriarchal order. That is what symbolically what the son or daughter of the widow means. The two other conditions are really interesting. One is that the seeker must find their way to the Grail, into the presence of the Grail, which in this case of the story is the castle where the Grail is kept, without actually knowing how to get there. So there's a wonderful element of spontaneity in this story. There's no program that's going to show you how to get there. Life itself, by the serendipity of life, and by the open-ended design of your own life adventure, will bring you to the place where you will encounter the Grail, according to the story. Then the third condition is that the seeker who finds him or herself in the presence of the Grail must ask a question to the Grail, but not be told beforehand by anyone what that question is.
We are back in the free zone with author John Lamlash, and he was going to clue us in on the question, the final requirement of the seeker, the third requirement of the seeker of the veil, the Grail. So, John, if you want to take it from there.
Sure. This is what you could call an archetypal theme in mythology, but it is also, at the same time, a very deeply existential question. I would say that every single person who wants to establish a deep relationship to the sacred, direct and interactive relationship, not based on belief, but on testable experience, must ask this question, this exact same question, which is called the Grail question in the studies of comparative mythology. Everyone must ask this question. And the form of this question is, humanity, what are you suffering from? You know?
Wow.
Another way to say it is, humanity, how are you wounded? One of the things that gives the story of Parsifal such a profound appeal is because it concerns the wounding of humanity. It says we are a wounded species and there's something wrong with us. Not in the sense that we've fallen from a perfect state, not in the sense that we are sinners, but there's something not right about the way we live. We are somehow spiritually and morally wounded. And one of the reasons why the story of Parsifal is inescapable and why it has so much to teach us is because it addresses this matter. The figure of wounding in the Parsifal story is the Grail King himself, the Fisher King. And his name is, in the medieval language of ancient French, Enfermitas, or in the German, Anfortas. And Enfermitas means infirm, ailing, hurting, suffering. So, the question that every one of us must bring, and it must come spontaneously out of your own heart, nobody can prompt you to ask this question. You must turn to the human race and you must ask, you know, what's hurting you? What's hurting you, humanity? Why are you suffering? Why are you less than you could be? Why are you acting in a confused and hurtful manner? And this is really the heart of the whole turning point of humanity. This is the turning point. Each one of us, when we can ask this question, there is a great, great turning point in your life.
Okay, that's powerful.
It is.
It's food for thought.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot, in at least in my perspective, John, a lot of what ails us is the overriding, the conditioning that leads us to not see Gaia as sacred. And we're distracted by so much illusory, archontic artifacts, whether it's television or false culture. And I understand, in my perspective, the Parsifal story being so important because it's a genuine directive myth. Could you please define for our listeners the difference between a genuine directive myth and overriding?
Sure. The genuine directive myth, like the myth of the divine Sophia from the Mysteries, which is, technically speaking, a creation myth. It explains the creation of the Earth, the origin of the human species in the galactic center, and so forth. Also explains the origin of deviant mind parasites and their presence in our reality. And that is a creation myth. And then Parsifal is a quest myth. And these myths are directive myths. What does this mean? It means that when you read them and absorb the stories, it acts upon you. It's sort of like, what do you say, is it the red pill or the blue pill? Which is the one that Neo takes that shows him the real matrix? The red pill.
Is that it, Jack? The red pill?
I
always
so.
Get confused.
Yeah, me too. Let's just say the blue pill is normal, but if he takes the red pill, his eyes are open. You know, absorbing these directive myths is like taking this pill. You cannot take this myth on board into your consciousness without it changing you. It engages you, and you engage it. And it shows you how to move through your experience. It directs your experience. Whereas a myth that is not directive is simply one that explains something that happened, but in a way that is really of no consequence, you know? And most of the ancient myths that we would read about, if you would go look in an anthology of Greek or Latin mythology, most of them are just interpretive myths, you know? Like there's a myth that says that there's someone called Icarus. His father was Daedalus, and he was a craftsman. This is a Greek myth. And he made these wings, and then Icarus glued these wings to his body with wax, and he flew into the sky, but he flew too close to the sun, and then the wax melted and he fell to the ground. This is not a directive myth. This is just a myth that, say, explains something, perhaps a human arrogance or a human hubris or something like that. So when I talk about directive mythology, I'm not talking about just using myths to interpret your experience. I'm talking about the myths that have the power to direct and guide your life. These myths are as good as any human guide that you would ever have. If you're lucky in your life to have a teacher who can put you on the right course in life, which is the course of your true potential, that's what these myths will do. That's what a directive myth will do.
Thank you.
And you asked about overwriting. The problem is that we are all born into cultures where we are programmed by the culture. programming begins with family, with the family history. It goes into our educational system, programs us. Whatever religious group we happen to be born into programs us. Then the government programs us. The media programs us. The internet programs us. This is all what the Gnostics call the archontic activities of human nature. They are our activities of layers and layers of behavioral programming. And these layers of programming overwrite the power that we have inside us to find our real connection to the divine and the sacred. And so that's why these directive myths of Parsifal and Sophia are uniquely important among all the myths in the world, because they will carry us through this programming and they will return us to the powerful and interactive relationship with the sacred that we lost. And that's why humanity suffers. That's the answer to the question, why do we suffer? Because of two things. We lost our immediate experiential connection to the divine. It got overwritten by religious programs such as Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. I would point out that these religions do not offer religious experience. They actually get in the way of genuine religious experience by writing beliefs into the human psyche, writing and coding us with beliefs that actually prevent us from having religious and spiritual experience. So, the problem is that we have been alienated from the sacred, and the second problem closely related to it, and this is probably even a deeper answer of why humanity suffers so much, is because we have lost the direct knowledge of our own true potential. We were talking about why humanity suffers, which is the grail question. The question that Parsifal asks and that leads to the turning point for humanity is the turning point. And there are many answers to that question of why humanity suffers, and we can each have a piece of the answer, which is very beautiful. Mm-hmm. No one definitive answer. Each of us as a human being can bring a piece of the answer and therefore contribute to the healing of the wounded grail king.
Wow.
But basically, when we look at the mystery schools, we find that they had a solution to that question, because in the mystery schools we were taught what our divine potential is. We were taught that we were not created by an extraterrestrial race of the Anunnaki or some superior reptilians. We were actually engineered. The human genome was engineered in the core of this galaxy of ours by divine beings who cannot correctly be visualized in any anthropomorphic form whatsoever. They were just pure energies. And so our potential, our human potential, derives from these divine beings. And because we are ignorant of it, if we don't know the origin of our own species, we don't know the potentials that were encoded in us by these godlike beings called aeons, we're going to be completely lost. So the Holy Grail is, in a sense, the enlightenment of our divine source that leads us back to our potential. And then we can act from that potential, and we can create an entirely different world in living in that manner.
Okay. Well, we certainly would like to hear a little bit more about, I think there's a lot of people that would like to hear a little bit more about the deviant mind parasites that you mentioned and that you just sort of alluded to right there. We only have about a minute and a half in this short segment, so if you could maybe just wet our taste buds a little with it, and then we'll come back to it.
Sure. If you've heard about the Gnostic writings, you probably may not have heard my version or my scholarly reconstruction of that material. It's drawn from books, ancient parchment books that were discovered in Egypt in 1945. They're called the Nag Hammadi Codices. And in these codices, you have the most complete and ancient, oldest textual description of mind parasites or ET-type aliens that intrude upon our species. Now, The Nag Hammadi writings of the Gnostics are notable for any number of reasons beside that, but that is certainly in itself a very remarkable point.
We are back in the free zone with author John Lamb Lash, and we were just about to launch into the subject of deviant mind parasites. So,
right.
If you'd like to pick it up from there, John?
Sure. What I would point out first is that the Sophia myth of the mysteries is a complete and coherent and unique myth, unlike any other I have ever found. And I've studied all the creation myths of all the cultures of the world, anything you can name. This one is outstanding because it is an actual full scenario of planetary evolution. It actually tells us how the Earth originated, how the solar system originated, tells us what is the origin of the human species, all these questions that we need to know in order to know who we are and know what we're doing here on Earth. What is the purpose of the human presence here? It answers all those questions in a way that other myths do not.
Wow.
Wow. I guess that's some archons that just splitting town is because they're terrified. Because I'm
honestly, I think the universe can sort of underscore how something isn't important, you know, because you'll have a thought that's really profound and then a bird will cry. And so I think that was just the you know, Gaia speaking to us and emphasizing what you just said, Mr. Lash.
That, nice. That could well be. Sounds more like Archons burning rubber to me and getting out of the hell out of town.
Right.
They better get out of town because
yeah, right.
They're running out of their ass, you know.
Yep.
So, this wonderful story of the divine goddess Sophia, who is now embodied in the living presence of the Earth, begins in the galactic center. And one of the amazing, this is an amazing story, and you can read about it in 9 episodes on my website, or you can read about the same 9 episodes I've condensed it into 9 episodes in my book, Not in His Image. One of the wonderful things about this story is that we learn in the story that the goddess Sophia was a presence called an aeon, which means a generator, a powerful spiritual energy, alive, conscient, sentient, superconscious entity in the galactic center in a company of other beings. And these aeons are kind of like scientists and artists. And what they love to do with their time is to invent these experiments. And then they inhabit the galactic center, which might be considered the hub of our galaxy, which might be considered to be a laboratory and an observation booth. But the experiments that they conceive and engineer and set in motion do not occur in the observation booth or in the central laboratory. The experiments occur in the galactic limbs. Why is that so? Simply because the divine experiments that the gods imagine and cook up have to take place in particular settings. And those settings are planetary worlds and solar systems where sentient beings and different kinds of animal forms can live, inorganic and organic beings. And so nothing like that can live in the galactic center. So this is very clearly laid out in the Gnostic mythology, the difference between the galactic core, which is called the pleroma, and the galactic limbs, which is called the kenoma. So anyway, as the story goes, the divine Sophia was involved in engineering the human species. We want to know where we originate. We originate in the imagination of divine beings in the center of this galaxy. And then the human genome was implanted, just rather in the way that a sperm would be implanted in a womb in an act of insemination. The human genome, the template of our species, was implanted in the third limb of this galaxy of ours in the Orion Nebula, which is an area that you can see on astronomical maps. And the way that evolution proceeds is that thread-like filaments consisting of chains of propagules or spores of life containing the human genome then disseminate through the galaxy and seed themselves in different planetary worlds, and the human experiment unfolds simultaneously in these different worlds. But the Gnostic myth says that there was one particular thing that happened. There's a couple of things that happened in the process of the emergence of our species that the goddess Sophia didn't expect to happen. And so we're presented with a myth that actually asks you to feel empathy for this divine being, because she became involved in the experiment of the human species. And as a result of that involvement, as a result of her passion and interest in the unfoldment of our species, things happened to her that she did not even anticipate. And this is just amazing to contemplate this, because you see, this is not a myth like the myth of the Creator in the Old Testament, where the Creator is omniscient and controls everything and knows how it's all going to go from the beginning and the middle and the end. Not at all. You know, this is very much a myth where we are involved in the fate of a divine being who is our progenitor, you know. And one of the first things that happened that was unexpected is that Sophia became so enthusiastic about this experiment of the human species and how we would unfold and how we would develop our divine potential that the gods had encoded into us, our talents to learn and experiment and innovate and create and share and discover the laws of nature and co-evolve with nature. All these fantastic talents encoded into us. She became fascinated by how we would unfold them. And as a result, the myth says that she departed from the galactic center. She fell from the galactic core, and she got involved in the mechanics of and in the physics of the galactic limbs. And that's a very exceptional situation, because generally speaking, the aeons or gods in the galactic center do not do that. They're like scientists who stand back once they set an experiment in motion. They leave it alone to proceed on its own terms, because that's what's fascinating to them, to see how it will work itself out without their interference. But Sophia got involved in our experiment, and this produced a number of unanticipated side effects. And the first side effect, which is clearly described in this Gnostic mythology, is that the impact of her pleromic energies, that is, imagine it as a pure, high, high energy plasmic light force, because this is what's at the center of the galaxy, a pure pool of plasmic luminosity, spiked into the galactic limbs and impacted the realm of matter that is floating in the limbs, and created what is called, what you might consider as a kind of fracture zone. Imagine hitting a pond, dropping something very heavy like a wrecking ball into a pond that created a fracture zone in the pond. And Sophia created a fracture zone. This is not something she intended to do in the third galactic limb of our galaxy. And in that fracture zone arose this weird species called the Archons. Why are they called Archons? It's very simple. It comes from the Greek word archai, which means from the beginning, from the start. What the Gnostic seers wanted to tell us here, and this is a true description of the cosmology of our planet, this is not a made-up story, what they wanted to tell us was that these Archon species, which is like a cyborg locust, originated first, before the solar system was created, and even before the Earth was created. The Earth was created only later. So according to the Gnostic cosmology, there are two stages in the creation of the current solar system. The first one is the production of the Archons, this cyborg Eki species, which consists of an gray alien type of drone and a reptilian overlord. And then they construct, with the intelligence given to them by Sophia, they construct the planetary system of the inorganic planets, not including the Earth. The Earth itself does not belong to the solar system, according to this Gnostic mythology. The Earth was created from the body or the plasmatic energy of Sophia herself. And it was captured in this inorganic planetary system inhabited by these archons. This is a very, very bizarre story. But I have to tell you that as more and more plasma cosmology emerges, and if you read about the electric universe, and if you read about the so-called experiment of the Acari insects, A-C-A-R-I, insects, that was conducted at the end of the 19th century, this whole Gnostic scenario becomes scientifically feasible. It is not scientifically feasible if you adhere to the fallacious and specious cosmology of Einsteinian relativity, quantum mechanics, black holes, quasars, string theory, which is all a bunch of crap. But it's easily proved to be a bunch of crap. It's easily proved to be a bunch of masturbatory fictions in the minds of mathematicians and engineers. But if you look to plasma physics and plasma in the electronic universe, you find that this Gnostic scenario becomes feasible. And that's how we understand the presence of these archonic mind parasites. They do not inhabit the Earth. They are never going to invade the Earth because they can't live in the terrestrial atmosphere. What they do is they can make forays into the Earth, kind of senseless raids that don't really lead to anything. And they can, more importantly, influence the human mind through a kind of telepathic or subliminal access.
Yeah, in relation to your condemnation of the scientific method there, mm-hmm. you did quote Reich again on your website. You wrote a quote from him about the biophysics of perception. According mm-hmm. to Reich, the scientist will increase his errors in proportion to the neglect of his own system of sensory perception and awareness. And then you said that scientific theory divorced from body and sense will only lead to the confusion and contradiction, which is inevitable, as long as we can continue to investigate exclusively by physical instruments and mathematical analysis, a universe whose foundations lie in the realm of mind and consciousness.
That's absolutely right, and that is one of, thank you for bringing that up, Joel. It's one of the most important messages that I want to get through on my site. Reich also said, and I love this quotation, sensation is the greatest mystery of natural science. You know? Mm-hmm. Just think about that. A science which ignores sensation, which treats our instrument, our bodily instrument, and its the five senses of sight, seeing, touch, taste, smell, and hearing as illusory, is never going to get to the true physics of this universe, you know. I'll tell you, the highest technology in the world is the technology of your mind-body system. Not your mind alone, not your body alone, but your mind-body system is the highest technology on this planet. And we can know everything through our mind-body system. One of the reasons that humanity has lost the way is that our natural intelligence has been overwritten by these archontic programs, by simulations, by models of models and copies of models that take us entirely away from the evidence of our own senses. The Sophianic vision brings us back to the evidence of our senses and gives us confidence in everything that we can know. And there is a continuity that you can experience between the natural sense world and then going into that world, into the supernatural, which underlies it, so that you can experience the natural and supernatural together. This is the great science of Gnosis, and this is what was taught in the mystery schools. So just to recap on the archons, because people are really interested in this subject, yes, you find in the Nag Hammadi writings the earliest textual description of extraterrestrial intrusion. You find the allusion to two types of ETs that are predatory. Now, I'm not saying that there couldn't be many interdimensional beings that interact with the human species. I believe there are. And indigenous peoples around the world, such as the Hopi or the Australian Aborigines, all say this. But The important thing is that we would identify the one predatory species that can cause us great harm. This is the archons. And they have two forms. They manifest in an embryonic type, which is said to resemble an aborted fetus. That means a prematurely born human form with a big head and spindly limbs. Whitley Strieber's gray ET. And they also manifest in an overlord type, which is the Drakon, D-R-A-K-O-N, or the reptilian type. So these two predatory ETs were identified by the Gnostics thousands of years ago. I believe that they knew about these for many thousands of years through their shamanic investigations and through their skill as in parapsychology and in investigating the paranormal, because they were experts in those realms. And they warn us about the behavior, the modus operandi, the way these beings operate. They are present in the solar system because of Sophia's own impetuosity. She, in a sense, is responsible for them being here, interfering in our experiments. She's very concerned about how we deal with them, because when she originally conceived the divine experiment of humanity, they weren't in the picture.
Okay, there were unintended consequences. And this is spoken of in the Nag Hammadi Library. Could you, for our listeners, sort of direct them as to which specific material covers the two species of archons?
I certainly will. There are 52 documents in the Nag Hammadi Library. Only about 35 of them are of any significance. So it's really a mess and a jumble. It takes a lot to sort out. Among those 35 that are really worth your attention, there are about five that are cosmological treatises, okay? And they contain large chunks of the Sophia myth, the Sophia creation myth, which I am citing here. Unfortunately, none of them contains a complete and coherent version of the myth. I have had to reconstruct it from the different sources. If you go to the homepage of metahistory.org and you look in the right-hand column, you'll see that it says Nag Hammadi Reading Plan. Click on that, and it takes you to my commentaries on the Nag Hammadi writings. And then you want to click on two particular cosmological treatises. On the creation of the world is one, and the other one is the reality of the archons. And in these, click on those and you will see where I reconstruct the cosmology of this, of the presence of the archons and profile the archons. Also, if you go to the site guide of Metahistory, and if you click on Gnostique, you'll find, if you scroll down, the archon files. And there you will find an enormous amount of material drawn from the Gnostic sources, explaining the nature and behavior of the archons and how we are to deal with them. This is another thing that I would point out, and I wouldn't want to talk about this subject without mentioning this. The Gnostics were extremely clear that we cannot be overpowered or ruled or dominated or enslaved by the archons. The only thing we can do is be enslaved by our own ignorance. And they make it very, very clear how we can make ourselves immune to this psychic intrusion. If you read Kundalini and the Alien Force, which is in the Archon Files, I quote the Gospel of Philip, one of the Nag Hammadi doctrines that describes how we use Kundalini to throw around ourselves a protective aura of luminosity to ward off the Archons. Another text called the Gnostic Catechism tells how to actually deal with abductions, with the threat of archonic abduction, which, by the way, are virtual reality experiences. They don't actually happen. The archons have one supreme ability, which is called HAL, H-A-L. It's a Coptic word, and it means simulation. So they can actually intrude upon our minds so much that they can project a human being into a virtual reality scenario that person takes for real. And that is what ET abductions are, according to a Gnostic analysis.
Okay, well, we're back in the free zone with John Lamb Lash, and we've taken an amazing turn in our dialogue this evening. If you want to just continue where we left off, John?
Sure. I think in bringing this all around to the home stretch here, I'd like to point out that if you go to metahistory.org and you look on the left-hand column, you see the face of Kali, my spiritual guardian, and right under that you can click on Psych Guide. And something I did recently was I added a spoken tour to Psych Guide. So the Psych Guide to metahistory.org is like 24 pages long. It's a massive amount of material on this site, and I don't want anybody to get lost in my site. You know, it's an online classroom, and you just have to know which class you want to attend and which class you want to, which course you want to sit in on. So I would suggest that you go and just listen to me, and I'll walk you through the whole site. And when you get down to the section called Gnostique, you'll find that it's broken up into five parts, and one of those is the archive files. And those of you who are interested in the Gnostic view of alien intrusion, which as far as I know is the best thing going on this planet, it's the most lucid and voracious explanation of the alien problem that we have. Look at the Archon files. You'll find under the Archon files every single thing that you need to know about this, including how to resist this alien intrusion. And included in the Archon files is this one very important piece, which has gotten a lot of circulation, called Who Wrote the Reptilian Agenda? And I just want to point out that many of you have probably heard about this Anunnaki theory, that there was an advanced extraterrestrial race that may have been coming on, inhabited another planet called Nibiru or whatever. And in the works of Zachariah Sitchin and in the work of David Icke and other people like that, this Anunnaki, these Anunnaki entities who are actually the Archons, get a lot of press. But as far as I'm concerned, they get the wrong kind of press. Because if you read the Gnostic materials from Nag Hammadi, you will find that they contain a critique and deconstruction of this Anunnaki story. And the bottom line, as I explain in Who Wrote the Reptilian Agenda, is that the Anunnaki story, which claims that we are a slave species engineered by these ETs, is disinformation.
Okay.
You don't have to take my word for it. This is what the ancient Gnostic seers told us. That it's disinformation, it's a lie. It's a lie implanted in our minds by these archontic beings to make us believe that they have far more power over us than they do actually have.
Okay, this is a prevailing theme that we're getting. Yeah, I understand.
More and more. You know, people are buying this theme, and I can understand why, because in certain respects, when you look at the world today and you see that we are enslaved, in our economic and social systems, we are enslaved in our religious belief systems, then it's natural to ask, well, why are we so enslaved, you know? We could say that it would be a form of the Grail question, you know? Humanity, why do you appear to be so enslaved? But, as I pointed out, the Anunnaki scenario of Zachariah Sitchin is not the answer to that. The Anunnaki scenario is a lie that pretends to be the answer. We are not a slave species. We are the products of the imagination of a divine feminine being called Sophia, who wants us to know her, to see her, and to be co-evolve with her in a divine experiment of her conception. She did not intend that the Archons would be involved in this experiment, but it so happens that they are, and as such, they represent a test for us. If we can face this one predatory species and overcome them, we can clear humanity out of almost all of its problems.
Okay. Well, John, to bring it back around again, you define a term called echonosis as an intimate perception of the life force of the Earth such that it brings humanity into alignment with Sophia's correction. Could you define the term Sophiac correction for the listeners tonight?
Sure. On the basis of what I've been able to tell you so far about the Sophianic creation myth, you could say that Sophia made some mistakes. Even gods can make mistakes. Just imagine that, you know.
Yeah.
Even divine beings with a consciousness infinitely more complicated and evolved than us can make mistakes. Why? Because the essence of the universe is novelty and freedom. So, the challenge is to see what those mistakes are and to learn from them and correct them. So we are involved with Sophia's correction. Sophia's correction involves two things. One, that humanity itself would face the Archon presence and would defeat the illusion and the lie and the deceit of the Archons, which is deeply ingrained in human behavior. Many human beings, although the Archons cannot embody themselves on this earth, but many human beings have become archontified in their practice of deceit. So the test is to correct our own behavior by looking through the patterns of deceit and manipulation that prevail in this world. We all must face this. This is a huge responsibility. The second part of the correction is cosmological. Sophia herself, when she fell out of the galactic center and became inordinately involved in the human experiment, lost contact with her own source. So her correction is to realign herself with the galactic core, with the realm of the Pleroma. And that alignment has begun as of March 19th, 2011. If you think of Sophia, if you think of the Earth as a mother ship that lost contact with the home port that it departed from and is sailing in stormy seas, but manages to reestablish signal contact with the home port, this is Sophia's own correction. And she has made that correction as of March 19th of this year. And so now there is an alignment, as it were. There is a communication between the planet Earth as a living entity and the origin of the planet Earth in the galactic core. And that is going to change everything on this planet very, very rapidly.
Wow.
And those of us who are on board for that experiment will be part of that change.
Excellent. Jack?
And I totally agree with you, John. That kind of speaks to something we were discussing. Like you mentioned at the beginning of the show, if I can find my notes here, about how we not only exist in the biosphere of Gaia, but within her imagination. And it seems like just getting in touch with that imagination is the key, whether it's swimming in the ocean or going out into the woods. She's there for us.
She is, and I'm glad you brought this up, because I want to close with one really essential point, and this is one of the most profound guidelines that could be drawn from the Mystery School teachings. You know, imagination is a faculty that was given to us by Gaia and by the divine beings. It is part of our endowment as a species. But we can use imagination wrongly. We can use it for pretending. We can use it for fantasy. We can use it for escapism. We can use it to do very sick things, like serial killers use imagination to do sick things. The globalist psychopaths are using their imagination. Satanism, in the sense of a globalist conspiracy, is a deviant use of the imagination. So I'd leave you with this insight. Gnostics taught that the true imagination of our species that can guide us in the proper direction is the one that includes her story, and that includes her. And the false imagination that will lead us to self-annihilation excludes her.
Excellent.
And this is all we have to know, is the difference between the true and false imagination.
Thank you so much, author John Lamb Lash from MetaHistory.org, for being with us tonight. Thank you for staying up late this evening to convey all this great information. And everyone out there,
see you again.
Excellent. Everyone out there, visit MetaHistory.org. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Goodbye.